session number 22084, Reel 7.
Started thinking a little about
This is the third reel of a taped interview with Keith Potter in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 12th of the 6th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Keith, before we go any further, I wanted to ask you what the feeling was like in the situation of being attacked from the air by a Stuka. What can one do?
Pray and hope that it has some benefit. Not much else. You go to ground as quickly as possible, and you make sure your head's covered. Often you might only have your steel helmet for that, or apart from your other clothing. And you just wait. I guess the same as anybody in London, wherever they're bombed, you just hope that the bomb doesn't land on top of you.
What's the feeling?
But the feeling with Stukas, it can be quite horrifying, or not horrifying, that's perhaps no extent, but when you hear the whining as they scream down at you and so on, it's there is a little bit of excitement and interest, and as well as a bit of fear. You know, you can't be attacked by a Stuka coming down without having something of fear. But there's also the interest in watching it coming down, and the noise, and particularly when one gets hit, it's terrific, particularly if you can go and look at it the next day or two, or and you know, examine it more closely. It's quite interesting. I think the worst, or worst, it's all relative, but we're having a swim on this particular occasion, and we had no bathers, of course, so we were swimming in the nick, and then over came a strafing plane. So I remember putting my steel helmet on and lying on the beach with my steel helmet, feeling terribly nude. It's amazing how vulnerable you feel when you're in the nude and you've only got your steel helmet on. Fortunately, nobody was hit.
What about the sense of helplessness that must surely come with that experience?
Yes, there is, John. So I think it must be a very common feeling, that sense of helplessness. You can't do anything about it. Just hope it doesn't hit you. I think it's about probably as simple as that.
So were you ever attacked by tanks in a close situation?
Yes, I can give you a far more explicit idea of that when we get on to the Alamein section of it, because we were taken prisoners by tanks. So we had a very close situation.
All right, we'll remember that for that point. I wanted to ask you, and you'd spoken about your mother sending you a cake, what was the importance of getting letters, information from home?
Oh, of enormous importance to know everybody was, and to just have the contact. And I must say that my mother and father were both very good at writing letters to me and sending parcels and whatever I wanted.
How frequent were those that you received in Tobruk?
Well, they varied a lot because they had to obviously rely on the destroyers to bring them up. And so they're more spasmodic than regular, and a number would come at a time, but are very, very important for the morale of the troops. And at that stage they could send things, although my family sent me a watch because I'd lost mine on the ship I'd been boxing, put it down, and when I went to pick it up, somebody else had. So they sent me a watch. I never got it because it went down on the destroyer, was sunk. And that they also had my birthday present. But the cake wasn't over. The cake was on a separate. Thank goodness for that.
What were you able to tell them from your position?
Oh, very little. We were instructed about secrecy, and our letters were censored, and so I guess we just did I did anyway. I don't know what everybody else did, but I didn't tell them too much. And even as a prisoner of war, I would, if I wanted to tell them something a little bit more interesting, I'd try and veil it in code or in words that they could put together for a different meaning.
How did that frustrate your feelings about the situation?
Well, life wasn't one full of frustrations. Life was sort of more acceptance. There it was. It was you're doing something interesting. You're alive. You're fighting a war. There wasn't too much real introspection. I suppose any introspection, most introspection I had was how to handle and get the best out of some of the difficult people I had under my control. I often remember at night walking up and down in the dark, working out with some particular difficult character what I had to do to get him properly motivated. I suppose that was... But I can't remember too much other angst and so on. I can remember getting virtually wanting to get out of Tobruk, and I happened to be, of all things, this was in the back area in the Blue Line, and I was sitting on a toilet, and one of these little bugs, little insects on my head, came on my arm, on my hand, and I understood that if they burrowed in and you brush them off, the head would stay and you get a little infection, so that was enough to get you out of Tobruk. So I remember saying, bite your little bugger, bite your little bugger, but it didn't. So,
on leaving Tobruk, what were your feelings?
Well, I think my feelings were not one of great elation that I was getting out of Tobruk, although I suppose once I can't remember those feelings, I would imagine that I did have them. But I can't remember being so overwhelmed that it's a highly conscious memory of saying, I'm getting out, whoopee, or anything like that. Naturally, I was glad to be getting out and alive. Getting to the particular hospital, that was an interesting one because it was a British hospital, and they were still running along medieval lines. For example, all the walking wounded, or whatever they had in my ward, when the duty officer came around, each wounded soldier had to get out of his bunk and stand there to attention with his board, like as if he was shouldering a rifle, and the officer would come around and inspect it. And then you'd be given orders and you'd hop back into bed again. A cake. In any event, being close to a town or city was a little bit too much of a temptation for me, so I managed to secure somebody to make me a shirt and shorts made. And so on this particular night, I went to the toilet and shoved my own pajamas and stuff up by the cistern, and went out on leave, AWL, and I went into the city, and it was... Now, that was interesting because cars and so on, all these lights and flashes, every light, a red light, was like a tracer bullet going past, and every explosion of a car or something, it created its own warlike atmosphere. It was not easy to immediately dismiss. And that was... You knew it wasn't a war, but it just seemed like it because you were... After a few months of that sort of action, that's the way my mind was running. So I found myself in a nightclub called the Sweet Melody. Now, it would not have been the most extravagant, nothing like a Shepherd's Hotel one It was a bit of a second rate, and the orchestra was in a mezzanine sort of balcony, and they had wire mesh over so you couldn't throw bottles at them. And during the night, somebody was going around saying, it'll be on, the action will be on tonight. In other words, stimulating a little bit of nonsense. So finally, it came. And I really didn't intend to participate in it, but the Egyptians were coming around and stacking the chairs. And so they had these chairs reasonably high, and I picked up my chair, and I said, coming, George, and I flung him it at him for him really to catch and put on the stack. Perhaps it might have been a little bit more forced. Anyway, he jumped aside and hit the stack, and over it went, and that started, everybody started piling their chairs in and everything else. Until finally, I think the manager of the place came up to me with a bottle of wine and said, you're a good fellow, Sergeant, you better go now. So I think I must have been letting off a little bit of steam also in there. I went back, and of course they'd found my gear, and I hadn't found me, and so I suppose they could have court-martialed me, but I don't think they wanted to do that. So they got out of it by transferring me into Alexandria to 11th AGH Hospital, Australian Hospital. And my cousin was a nurse there. Well, from I went from the gourblimey to the sublime. I was waited and feted, and she and her nurse friends were always coming up and giving me something or taking me out on leave, and it was a great time. and even Blamey, General Blamey's wife came in, and Blamey came in and met everybody and shook hands with us and so on, gave us an orange. And
can you tell us about that occasion, what your impressions of Blamey and his wife were?
Well, I thought his wife was quite attractive. She had red hair, as I remember, and a nice friendly manner. Blamey was shortish, stocky, and with his bristling moustache, and he looked very somewhat officious, friendly officious, I'd say, and something in the British mould in the way he was. I wouldn't say he was a totally friendly man, but he was endeavouring to be friendly. And he asked me where I was wounded, and I must confess at the time I thought, where, in the body or in what area? So I said, I've told him I was wounded in the head into Rook, so that hopefully that answered both questions. Oh, well done, or something like that nature, and I need move. It's simple as that, nothing.
What was the troops' genuine feeling towards Blamey at that time, and then having him come through and greet you?
Well, we didn't even discuss it. You don't really discuss those sort of things with other people much. It just sort of, it happens, and it happened, and that was it. And I think in these sort of situations, you don't mix with a lot of fellows and talk about it. Each one has his own position and his own sense of space and isolation. And you don't discuss it much with the people next door that I can't remember. There's sort of no, I think that's more of a mature thing where you'll sit around, say, in a bar or over coffee and discuss these things with the deep issues of something. But when you're young, you don't do that. Well, I didn't anyway.
You know, I'm interested to find out the level of confidence that there was with the people that were in higher command. In Morshead's case in Tobruk, Blamey, people had gone.
We had enormous confidence in Morshead. Enormous confidence in him. The higher echelon levels of movement in the war, with Freiburg and so on, the other people who'd been, we really, soldiers in the line like that really don't get too much to grips with what is happening. And I suppose for the senior officers in the mess, they would discuss all that sort of thing. But even then, when you're in a a battle situation. You're not mixing together like that in any event. And I can't recall ever sitting down with my platoon or company and discussing the major issues of the war like that. I think it would have, I don't think that's where our level of interest sort of really lay. And the level of conversation in an infantry company often doesn't reach those levels. It's more in survival and women and girlfriends and what that sort of stuff.
Possibly we can talk about those areas a little later as well. I was interested in finding out what the situation was in regard, having been in a war situation and now in this complete opposite. Were you interested in knowing what was going on back at Tobruk? Were you interested in the fact that you were now in a situation completely different?
Yeah, you know, not clearly enough for me to be totally specific about it. So I have to fill in the gap there by imagining what it was really like. You would have to be aware of, you'd have to have an element of concern and interest in what was happening where you'd come from. But it seems to me, in retrospect, particularly in view of the questions that you've asked me up to now on the last couple of occasions, so I think, whilst I did think a lot about issues and more as the war progressed, it was more going with the flow at the time. So you went along with it, you did what you had to do, you thought about it, you looked after at your own survival and your responsibility to the other people that you were with. And your concern was, A, to stay alive, B, to make sure you had enough food, and three, when the hell were you going to get out of it?
You met your cousin, and you were now going out on leave, seeing
Alexandria
on the opposite side. What were some of the things that you then did?
Well, with them, sightseeing. Then, on leaving them, I had to go to a staging centre, a convalescent depot is a term for it, with other troops, and we went across the Suez Canal to Portside, and we went sightseeing in Portside, and that was quite good.
What were some of the sights that you saw first in Alexandria and then Portside?
Well, in the company of my cousin and so on, they're very much the sights and the gardens and that sort of thing. And I suppose, because my head weird, it's about where I was at. And going through Portside, with a couple of other sergeants, I think we wanted to go and have a look at an exhibition. So we went and had a look at an exhibition, and on the way we got into a gharry to go back into the city area, or back to our camp, I suppose. And a little bit of trouble there. As we went through the village side, or the outskirts of the city, they started throwing rocks at us. So the sergeant I was with, quite a big fellow, hopped down out of the gharry to chase one of these fellows who had a whip, and as he got close to him, this kid just whipped him across the face and ran off. So I was still in the gharry, so the gharry driver and I tried to follow them down, but then we were being led into less savoury areas, and so finally it was just looked too serious, and so our fellow got back into the gharry and off we went again. That was from then on, we had from the convalescent depot, of course, we had leave into Tel Aviv, Gaza, Tel Aviv, and Haifa, and so on.
You were to have left Tobruk around September, as I understand.
Yes.
Just going back a bit, in June, May and June, there was the attempt to relieve Tobruk with brevity and battle axe. Did you know anything about those occasions at all?
Yes. By your mentioning the name, so, and I really had forgotten about it, we were aware of it, and I can recall now that we had some element of expectation that we were going to be relieved. But it didn't happen. And time is too far distant now for me to give you much more detail about that unless I start reading a few books and find out what really happened about that time.
At the time, what was the feeling then of knowing you weren't going to be relieved?
Oh, it would have to be one of disappointment. It'd be one of disappointment, because you know, a few months in that place, if you think you're going to be relieved, it's full of anticipation. It's like thinking you've won lotto and then nothing happens.
Continue on. You were to head off eventually to Syria.
Well, from there, I rejoined the battalion at Kylo 89. It was out of Gaza. And we did some more training there, and from there I went on leave to Cairo, and with a group of people, soldiers, and we were there for a week, and we had a very enjoyable time.
Can you give us an idea of the enjoyment?
More or less. We saw all the sights that one expected, and very impressed with places like the Blue Mosque and a whole range of places, and the Museum of Natural History and the Museum of Hygiene. That was an interesting one. In that, we went into a big room that was dealing with all the diseases of the male and female genitalia. And I found myself in the centre of this big square room, and on two sides were penises, or wax models, I guess, in all various sizes, shapes, and the diseases. Then on the other were all female organs in a similar situation. Well, I looked from one wall and looked to the other wall. Then I looked to the people standing alongside me, and it happened to be a girl probably around about 16 or 17 years old, and she was with somebody who possibly was her father, and he was a sheikh by the look of his turban, his hat. And we both grinned rather sillily, embarrassedly at each other. But that was sort of quite an interesting sort of situation. Apart from that, Cairo was good fun. It was different. But it was interesting in that the Australian soldier doesn't shine at his best in a place like that. And I'm not referring to us. We didn't get involved in any of these things. But we're in a particular bar, off the street bar, quite a nice place, with behind the counter rows of bottles. And while we were in there, some Aussie soldiers came in, and they used that as a Aunt Sally. They proceeded to pick up their glasses and so on from the table and hurl them at the rows of bottles and things. There were quite a few episodes of Australian troops that went things that made us very proud.
How can these sorts of instances be explained, do you think?
Firstly, I think it's the element of TV. The basic element is one of youth. One of youth going to war that can excuse itself perhaps with the thought that the individual might be killed. He may not come back. This is his, and he's away from home. Nobody knows him. We hadn't been brought up to respect other countries, other nationalities. We had something of the British impression that we were superior to everyone on earth, particularly Arabs and whatever. But even so, when the 2nd 28th arrived in Palestine, and they went on leave, the first leave to Jerusalem, if I had not mentioned this earlier, the first people they had a fight with the 16th Battalion. So there were people of the 11th, of the, sorry, the 2nd 28th Battalion fighting people of the 2nd 16th in their first battle against each other in Jerusalem. You know, it's, I think all this energy, like soldiers on I think it was the Queen Mary coming over, tipped a piano over the side of the ship. I think a lot of just sheer exuberant bastardry. I think that's about all you could say for it. But I must confess I didn't get involved in fights. Firstly, I'm not the biggest bloke in the world, although I did know how to box. I won two army boxing tournaments in the weights in the 1 year. But I found that you might be protecting yourself in the front, but you can't stop somebody putting a chair over your head from behind. I couldn't see much sense in getting involved, so I didn't.
Tell us then of making your way to Syria and what was involved in that particular instance.
After Christmas, probably in, about, from memory, January, February, perhaps, we went up to Syria, up to Tripoli. You would be aware that there are two Tripolis in the Middle East, and this was the eastern Tripoli, relatively close to the Turkish border, well down from Beirut, in the Lebanon, in the Levant. And we were at a camp, our area was at Beit Lara, and that's where we lived in our tents, in very close, in the, you might say, the country, and close to an Arab, small Arab village. And that was the most interesting time. The Lebanon is a fascinating place. And we went to the cedars and we saw snow and a whole range of interesting things. And we built our own defensive position because it was anticipated the Germans would come down through there. And it was a totally different terrain, obviously, to the desert, quite different. And so it was interesting to have to reconsider our battle training and defensive, like how we'd handle ourselves in action.
What was your awareness of the wider situation in the war at that stage? I mean, the Japanese had entered. Did you know about that, for instance?
Yes, we knew about that. We knew sort of the major things, and we were constantly wondering how it would affect us, what would happen. And then we were aware of the breakthrough by Rommel and the way he came straight down the desert, took Benghazi, took Tobruk from the South Africans. Our opinion of the South Africans dropped quite a lot at that time because we couldn't see how so many of them, there were quite a number of far more South Africans than there were Australians and British, how they could hand it over like that. We just found that incredible, quite incredible. Nevertheless, they did. And then they came down, as you know, to the Guattara Depression. And it was pretty close to that point. I remember on the 10th of June, which today's the 12th, I had my 20th birthday in the Forglas area, which is a desert on the pipeline out by Iraq. And the pipeline runs through there, and there's a desert area, and we are out for further desert training. So that was in June 42. Well, now, at that time, there was a plague of worms. A lot of troops were going down with worms, and we were told to watch for worms, and if we had them, to report them. So, of course, do this, you've got to examine your own feces. Now, there's certainly plenty of tin fruit. We're living on tin food. And so fruit salad and tin spaghetti and all that sort of stuff. Well, anyway, I happened to look down and notice on the rock, obviously, a couple of tapeworms there. So I reported to the doctor. He said, well, we've got to get you straight down to hospital. So hospital happened to be in Beirut. So I was immediately whisked out. Oh, by the way, just prior to that, a couple of days before, my company CO or OC, Osman Klein, Captain Bunting, I think it might have been a major then, was relieved and sent back to Australia to take over the command of the battalion here. That's incidental.